Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everybody. I'm Sam Wong, and thanks for giving us your time with our next chapter of Meet an Investor. Today, we have the privilege of meeting with Brian Bell. He runs Team Ignite Ventures. He runs a VC fund, and Brian is unique because the structure of his fund is a syndicated fund. So we're going to get into some of that here. If you're a founder, why would you be interested in taking money from a syndicated fund? Or if you're a potential investor, okay, if you want to dabble into the startup space and maybe get lucky with your potential investment, how could you potentially participate without being a deca millionaire or something like that? Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. I'm gonna introduce Brian, or actually ask Brian to introduce himself. Brian, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me. Hello, everyone. I'm looking forward to all your questions and illuminating the wonderful world of venture capital. So let's see. So I'm from Seattle. First decade or so, I did finance, Wall Street, CFA, all that stuff. Honestly, I hated it and washed out and kind of wandered around the world trying to figure out what I'd do if I won the lottery, which I feel like I have done now with venture capital. But that's kind of the punchline to the intro. But ended up in tech, as one does in Silicon Valley. Working at a lot of different startups, trying a couple of my own, lots of failure, lots of lessons. Was lucky enough to be at a unicorn called Rocket Fuel about a decade ago. Got really deep in AI. Ended up leading the AI category for AWS and launched SageMaker Marketplace. Went over to Azure Marketplace, led the category team there, and our job was to basically scale startups for Microsoft, which turns out is a pretty good training ground to be a VC. Working with the entire universe of companies and trying to figure out which ones are likely to grow if we invest Azure credits and dollars, marketing programs, resources into them. It was around this time I realized I was having more fun talking to founders than I was running a team at Microsoft. So I started angel investing. Did that for a couple of years, was in a bunch of venture funds, things like that. That turned into Team Ignite, which we called it Team Ignite because we wanted to have the LPs help ignite startups. We did about 50 investments through the syndicate, which is a pool of capital for individual deals, and had a bunch of really great markups. So we raised a rolling fund focused on YC investments. That was our first fund. And I went full time about a year ago. Got to the point where, you know, had enough exits and management fee income coming in to take a huge pay cut and do this full time and never looked back. I love what I do and happy to share my knowledge and whatever wisdom I've accumulated from other people, with you all.
That sounds great. It sounds like a similar journey. I was over at Cisco and had a big, fat, cushy job with a comfortable salary, but I enjoy what I do now so much more. Okay. Totally
You got to
understand.
find that thing, right? You got to find that thing that you do if you had 10 million in the bank,
Right,
and
right.
just kind of keep asking yourself that question. It took me 15 years of iterating and trying and finally figured it out. So that feels pretty good.
Do you have a specific goal with what you want to do with Team Ignite Ventures?
Yeah, I think the vision is to build the world's largest seed fund and organization and syndicate. You know, there's 10,000 seed fundings every year. Not that we want to invest in all 10,000, but I could see a path to maybe investing in the top 500 to 1,000 every year. That would obviously require lots of cash and lots of people. There's just so much opportunity out there, and I think AI is generating even more software, right? Software is eating the world. AI is now eating software, and so, you know, the future is very bright, especially for the early stage venture and startups.
Yeah, that's great. So does that mean you're spending a lot of your investment focus on AI companies, or do you have a specific focus?
What's cool about having a syndicate, or the YC fund is you can kind of invest in whatever looks good. We tend to invest in B2B SaaS, fintech, and AI. These are areas that I know and understand. I have 115 portfolio companies now. Four of them have shut down and they were all consumer. So I tend not to invest in consumer stuff I don't understand. I tend to invest in things where I think I can add value. And that's a big part of being a VC is you have to have a reason to be on the cap table, right? Like why would the founder take your money, right? And so you kind of have to look at yourself and say, what do I know? What do I understand? Where can I add value?
Ah, interesting. Okay. So what you just said here suggests the fact that you have to demonstrate to a founder what value you add. I think a lot of founders can be desperate as long as they have anybody who's willing to write a check that's, oh, yeah, I'll take it. What do you see as a pitfall of potentially taking any money, just taking random money from anybody who's willing to write a check? Do you see any problems with that?
Yeah, it depends on where you're at in the round, right? If you're super early and you're having trouble raising cash and somebody offers you 500,000 and there's some family office that has, they've made their money on, I don't know, they're the Coors family from, Colorado, right? And they made billions of dollars selling beer. Like, but you have a B2B SaaS, a startup, there's obviously not a kind of investor founder market fit there. But let's say you haven't raised any money, you might want to take that 500K, and then that way you can go out to other VCs and say, "Hey, I got half the round filled already." If you're raising a million, let's call it, or "Hey, I'm already oversubscribed." You always want to raise from a position of strength, right? And you don't want to seem desperate, but you also want to get the right people on the cap table to help you. So it's kind of a song and dance, and it's a little bit of a pony show and a little bit of posturing, kind of a sales process for both parties, for the founder and for the VC.
It's interesting hearing you talk about your background going through Wall Street and finance, then getting into a startup that did well, and then also working with AWS and Azure as almost a startup enabler, startup evangelist, or startup development guy. Okay.
Yeah.
So, with that type of background, how do you see that? How do you position that against the average investor who maybe might just be a finance guy only?
Yeah, I mean, it makes me a better investor, I think. And I'll hear this from founders a lot. They'll spend that 30, 60 minutes with me, and at the end they'll be like, "This is the most valuable investor call I think I've ever had." Because I understand what they're doing and what they're going through. I spent 20 years building products, starting companies, failing a lot. I've j done just about every functional role you can at every kind of company. Because again, I was looking for that thing that I would do if I had 10 million in the bank, right? So I've tried a lot. I've tried a lot of things that failed a lot. And I don't know how you could invest in companies and not have done anything yourself. Kids that come out of, Stanford undergrad and go straight to an MBA and then go straight to investing. There's just not a lot of value you can bring if you've not done anything. So I always thought I'd be a VC when I retired. I always thought I'd do it like in my 60s and 70s, but a friend of mine from grad school, he was like, "You probably should get going now, because you're going to make a lot of mistakes." And that was really good advice.
I love it. I absolutely have seen the exact same thing that you're talking about. I have met a lot of investors who don't have the operational experience, and that oftentimes is a hindrance. If you end up taking them on as an investor on your cap table, you'll probably have to spend a lot more time managing that particular investor, especially if they tend to be very opinionated about things. You'll probably have to spend a lot more time managing them than the average investor.
Yeah, and they may have different timelines than you as well. I mean, startups take 10 to 15 years to fully exit, in many cases, the really successful ones. So if you take money from somebody that doesn't understand that, and there's no liquidity, they may be pressuring you in ways that are not conducive to the long-term viability of the startup.
We saw that very clearly with one of the startups I was at, where I remember sitting in the board meeting with the investors, and I was 32 years old. I knew nothing. Okay. I was a VP at the company, but I honestly knew nothing about the startup investor space. And watching the investors kind of saying, stomp on the gas pedal, put both feet down, lead foot, lead foot, lead foot, effectively. And I'm thinking, gosh, if this was a car, the engine is redlining. Okay. And you're telling us to keep this up, we're going to blow a gasket. And sure enough, we did. I mean, we hit some of the goals in terms of what the investor wanted with speed, but the engine cracked
Yeah.
the head. Okay.
And
And
I mean, what you're describing too is venture capital isn't for every company, right? You have to be a infinitely scalable software company, in my opinion, or maybe a biotech company. B2B SaaS in particular has very high margins. So as you grow, you typically have a J curve, right? You're kind of
right,
burning
of course.
cash to grow, but then you harvest it much years later because you have all these subscriptions coming in, all that revenue. And that's why B2B SaaS is kind of the best business model ever invented, right? You kind of solve someone's problem and then you charge them monthly or annually forever to keep solving it for them. And then you figure out other problems that they have, and then you build additional features and products to cross-sell and upsell. I've never had a B2B SaaS company go out of business out of 115 companies now. Like I said, mm-hmm. four shutdowns, all consumer. Because typically we won't invest until post-launch and post-revenue. So you've proved that like you can hack something together, get people to pay for it. And we can get into, you know, how YC is a little different from that. I mean, in my opinion, like YC are kind of overpriced friends and family rounds. They call them seed rounds, but they're really kind of friends and family rounds that are $2 million rounds, but we can get into that.
Ah, very interesting. So you do mention something very significant. There was a report issued by Carta a while back on the state of pre-seed, and they break down the sub-industries of the seed, you know, seed investing space. B2B SaaS was the number one sub-industry or the revenue model, et cetera.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was like 40% of the space. So it's definitely something that's tried and true. And if you do have, sounds like if you do run a B2B SaaS company here, I would encourage you to make sure to see if you can, and hopefully I don't flood
reach
your
out to
inbox.
Us, yeah.
Yeah, reach out to Brian. Yeah. Because if he's already invested in dozens, maybe 100 or more B2B SaaS companies, I bet he's got some knowledge that can help you. Okay. I would definitely encourage you, Brian, if you're comfortable, you can put your.
Oh, yeah. Pitch.teamignite.vc. And you can find me on LinkedIn. The pitch link is right there. I welcome cold inbound. I get a ton. Obviously, I'm probably looking at 20 a day at this point, 30 a day. Wow. Yeah, it's a lot.
Okay. So if somebody is trying to reach out to you and get your attention, maybe what would you give advice to the people here? What would make you stand up and say, I want to talk to this person before I talk to that other person?
Yeah. Yeah. And I got a lot of bad inbound over the years. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I actually wrote an article, which is linked in my profile on LinkedIn as well. So if you search Brian Bell, Team Ignite Ventures, you'll find my profile. And there's lots of Brian Bells, by the way. So you got to kind of weed through us and find the right one. So I wrote an article on this, exactly how we evaluate companies. It's about 15 different things. We kind of rate them all on a 5-point scale. So when we get an inbound, we kind of look at the quality of the team. Can we add value? What's the traction? What's the market size and friction? And it's all listed out there on that article. So you can kind of look at that rubric and kind of say, am I coming across, am I putting my best foot forward here, with this deck? And, you know, we'll only spend 30 seconds on a deck, maybe a minute flipping through the deck to decide whether or not we want to meet. So I would look at some like TechCrunch teardown, deck teardowns. Those are really good. Mm-hmm. Or look at some famous YC companies, their decks from, you know, 5 or 10 years ago and how simple and clean they were. You don't need to say a lot to say a lot. You don't need to put a lot of things in your deck. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest mistakes I see is like you have hundreds of words on a slide, which is ridiculous. You look at some of the best decks in history, they have no more than maybe 10 or 15 words on each. It's a huge market because of X. We're the right team because of Y. And it's just very simple. You want to tell the investor exactly what to think.
Right, right. That sounds like great advice. And I'm going to segue a little bit here because it kind of dovetails with a lot of what we do at Fundable Startups. Well, we have a pitch scorecard. I have a blog that ties to that. And in that scorecard, there's various things in the structure that we put together here. But we've got our own criteria. It's also got a 5-point scale. There's 14 different rows. It sounds like you've got something very, very similar. Mm-hmm. So
we're almost exactly the same if we line it up, just
probably
maybe different wording. Yeah,
probably. In fact, we align our pitch deck training classes with some of the criteria here. I just did a pitch deck training last week for one of the accelerators where we were teaching the other advisors how to be able to help someone build a pitch. So it's very, very similar. If you're online, hopefully you can see the QR code. Go ahead and scan the QR code. You can go straight to that topic. Okay.
Nice.
But it sounds really good what you're describing here.
And get some feedback before you start sending your deck around. Find some other founders and send it to them or friends, obviously, or former colleagues and give them this rubric or mine and say, hey, just can you give me a scoring for all these things and then some feedback how to improve?
Yeah.
And do that 10 or 20 times before you start sending your deck around.
I would absolutely, absolutely agree. In fact, with this deck, if I just kind of went to the next slide, there's actually a lot of detail when we provide debt coaching. This is actually a screenshot of something that we did for a customer who, said, "Hey, can we get some coaching time from you and come up with some feedback?" This was our feedback to them. There was 1,500 words sometimes in some of the things that we provide. This one here only had a little bit under 800 words. But anyway,
Nice.
absolutely agree. Okay.
That's really cool. I didn't know you did
Yeah.
all that. That's awesome.
Yeah, we're very much into doing things the right way. And I did want to ask you real quick, Brian, help us understand. You mentioned a syndicate. What is a syndicate? A lot of people but maybe not don't know what that is.
Yeah, so we started as a syndicate. Again, we call it Team Ignite because we wanted to ignite startups as a team. So we have a couple thousand people now that can help ignite startups. Lots of tech execs, people in industry, engineers, product people, exited founders, recruiters, and the list goes on. Sales consultants, everybody you can possibly need as a startup is on Team Ignite. That's why we call it Team Ignite. Now, a syndicate is just that. It's just a group of people that want to help grow startups, and they'll pool capital and resources on a deal by deal basis to do so. The legal mechanism here is an LLC, right? So it's literally just a group of people in an LLC pooling their capital to invest in a startup. And you can think of like each deal is like a miniature fund. So when I started out, I did about 50 of these. Deployed about 5 million of capital, about 100K check size each. And it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work for a GP like myself that's emerging. I'm called an emerging manager. You're an emerging manager until you take institutional capital, which means you basically have like 100 million plus fund size, which I'm not there yet. But, so pooling lots of capital, wiring money, we used AngelList. AngelList is a great place to get started. For the founders on the call, why would you take money from a syndicate? You get a group of people, you get 20 or 30 people for one entry on the cap table that can help you. It's not a good place to start. It's a good place to finish. And what I mean by that is if you're just starting your round and you're going out and raising your first institutional round, so call that the post friends and family round. A lot of people go out and they raise that 250K from their friends and family for on like a 2.5 cap or even a million cap or something like that. So you're going out and you're raising your first 500K million, call it. You don't want to start with a syndicate. You want to start with actual VCs. Get somebody committed, maybe some angels. Syndicates are really good when you're finishing the round because people in the syndicate look for who else is investing. And if no one else is investing, they're like, well, why should I invest? And so it's like this catch 22 thing, right? Whereas VCs, they have dry powder, they have money to invest. So they're not afraid to be first or second, but syndicates kind of are because they tend to be LPs that aren't very sophisticated. They're amateur investors is how I might call them. They're kind of writing these little $1,000 to $5,000 checks and lots of different deals and kind of learning how to invest.
But
Long-winded answer. So ha happy to dig in there.
okay, it's interesting because I've never taken an investment from a syndicate, but it sounds like there is an opportunity since some of the LPs or the investors, they may not be professional investors with 20 years of VC seasoning, but they are probably business executives who can potentially help you more than the VC does.
Yeah, in many cases, the smaller the check size, the more valuable it is, which is something founders learn over time as well. Because when somebody writes 25K or 50K of their own money, they're really committed, they really want to see you succeed. And even like these little $1,000 or $5,000 checks inside of syndicated deals, they really want to see you succeed. They don't want to lose that $1,000. For them, that might be a lot of money if they make 200,000 a year. They're putting, a good chunk of their disposable investing income into your startup. So they really want you to succeed.
That's a very, very interesting point. It's like the old story of in the game of breakfast, there's a difference between the chicken and the pig. The chicken contributes an egg. The pig is committing himself, okay, or itself. All right.
Yeah, interested versus committed, I think. Yeah,
Yes,
exactly.
exactly. A contributor versus a committed
Yeah.
person. Okay. I can totally see that. So as we get to go through here, I'm going to encourage people to make sure you ask questions Put them in the chat window and we'll kind of catch up on some of the questions there. Try to focus a little bit more on a question that might have generic value instead of saying, I'm XYZ. Would you do that? Okay. Would you potentially invest me or something like that? Okay. So
Yeah,
we'll open up questions in a
definitely
moment.
if you're post-launch, post-revenue, B2B SaaS,
Okay.
pitch.teamignite.vc.
Okay. Got it. So there's a couple of low-level initial filtering criteria. It sounds like definitely take advantage of the article that Brian wrote. And that's a general advice that I would say is that a lot of founders make the mistake of just what I call spray and pray. They find anybody who's an investor and they just blast them with an email or a LinkedIn invitation or something like that. Take some time to look at the person who you're trying to lure as an investor. Understand what they do. If they have an article like Brian has himself, read the article. Evaluate how well you fit with what his investment criteria is before you waste your time and potentially Brian's time saying, hey, I'm, a B2C consumer startup with no revenue and whatever else.
Not a fit. That's why I put that on the actual page to pitch us as well. And I'll share the Substack article for people just so they have it.
Sounds great. Okay. Yeah. It looks like a couple of people have asked for that. So thank you. Let's take a couple of questions. Anirban mentioned how important is vesting for co-founders or the founding team?
I mean, absolutely important. You have to have it. I've seen cap tables ruined. We're in due diligence with a company right now where co-founder just left. He's fully vested. He has 25% of the company. Oh crap. What do we do? We basically got to buy him out or restructure. We got to figure out how to get this co-founder off the cap table. So yeah, 4-year vesting, very, very important. And even longer, really. Startups are 10-year projects, right? 5 to 10-year projects. So yeah, that's part of our due diligence. It's in our checklist there.
Well, the situation you described might just be what we call a broken cap table, an uninvestable cap table, unless you can fix it and recover from it. But
Yeah, you're gonna have to buy them out. They're like, well, wait, I just put in 2 years of work. I should get 25% of the company, right? No, like you've no. No, you deserve something, but not 25%. That's a tough
that's a
conversation.
super difficult conversation because you that person's probably gonna have to make some concessions and you have to convince them that, dude, you can get 25% of nothing. The company will go to zero, or you concede something and maybe you get 10% of something big. Okay, who knows? Okay, so Nadir asked a question: with high AI cost of goods sold and diminishing gross profit margins going below 75% gross margin, what principles would you look at when you're evaluating performance?
I love that. I love that question, right? Because AI right now, they look, if you squint at them, they're B2B SaaS business models, but they have very low margins because of the high AI costs, right? ChatGPT 4 and soon to be 5. I mean, they're extracting quite the utility tax, kind of like, we used to call it the Amazon tax. You build on the cloud and they extract, 10% of your gross margins forever. And it seems that we have this platform shift happening, and AI is going to be doing the same thing where all these apps are now built with AI. What's exciting about AI and just technology in general, why I love this stuff, is it gets twice as good for half the cost every year. And AI gets 10 times better because it's not driven by the underlying, doubling of price performance of computing technology. It's driven by something else. And I've written an article on my Substack about this, which is the complexity of the model architectures, right? So, these models are getting 10x more complex every, I think it's 6 to 12 months, which means, and this keeps happening, that right now what looks like not a good business could be a very good business in a year or two.
Okay, very interesting. And you just saw a small example of the benefit of having someone who knows the space better than just a check writer alone. Okay. Well, I think that's great. Let's see. Got a couple of questions. People just want to clear on what the email address is. So if you could pop that email address into the chat
Yeah,
now.
it's just Brian at teamignite.vc or teamignite.ventures.
Interesting. Paul asked a question. You're looking for a post-revenue company. If a company is already has revenue, why does it need to ask you for investment?
Well, it's because of the J curve of these SaaS companies, right? You're charging a monthly fee, you have a certain amount of CAC and operating overhead. And so it takes a while to pay back on subscription revenue. And a lot of times you're pricing this thing to capture market. You're not pricing it for profitability, right? I have a great friend of mine who was my boss 10 years ago, bootstrapped his startup to 3 million of ARR. Took him 8 years to get there. And we were just chatting the other day, and he's like, you know, I should have taken v venture capital. I could have $100 million. I could have, you know, 50% of a $100 million company versus 100% of a $3 million company. I could have grown faster. So a lot of what venture capital enables you to do is go capture the market and get big fast. Now, maybe that's not for you. Maybe you don't want to have $100 million, $1 billion unicorn kind of company, and that's fine. Don't take the venture capital, you know. But then you might regret it in 10 years.
So I think the nuance here is just because you have revenue doesn't necessarily mean you have the cash necessary to meet the goals of the company. Okay, you can do the slow roll, slow growth thing, but in some cases, it might be more beneficial to be able to get some gasoline, you got a small fire, get some gasoline, make the fire much bigger. Okay, but that's probably on a case by case basis, so I'm not going to say that's always the case, right?
Yeah, there's always exceptions. I mean, have I invested pre-revenue before? For sure. Yeah, but it's an exception, not the rule.
Okay, got it. Another question. How long does it typically take you to close an investment, and does it vary widely?
It does vary widely. I think probably the quickest. You know, the Y Combinator stuff moves very quickly. All the background checks and incorporation docs and all that stuff's kind of done for you when a startup comes out of an accelerator. So your due diligence process is a lot lighter. I've had due diligence processes spread out over many months, where I'm like, not quite there. Oh, you grew 50% month over month, and then it went flat. What happened? And then, you know, I passed on companies before where I don't see this working. And it really does work. And I'm like, okay, that I was wrong. But they still let me in a year or two later, and everything in between. So yeah, it varies widely.
Got it. So, have you led around previously, and would you consider leading around, or are you primarily following?
I never want to lead rounds. And I think it's because I don't have the time to go take board seats with a high volume strategy that I have, you know, 115 companies. Can't sit on 115 boards. I don't even want to sit on a single board. And in fact, I'm probably value destructive. I haven't been operating for years now. Like, you know, all of my expertise is out of date, and I'd probably give you bad advice anyway. And so, yeah, I think the best companies don't need my help, right? And so I'm trying to find the companies that actually don't need my help. The best founders I'd ever hear from, right? They just keep growing.
That's an interesting perspective. I do remember a couple of VCs talking about how they actually didn't want to take a board seat because technically, when you're taking a board seat, you should be working in the interest of the company, not the interest of yourself or your fund. And the reality is, many VCs, they really would prefer to work in their own interest. Okay. Which creates a little bit of tension then. Okay, you have to kind of figure out who is the right investor. Okay, so just a comment here. Raising first round, seed round is most difficult for founders. What's your opinion on it as an investor? What would you look for in a founder?
Yeah, so this is interesting. It is the most difficult round. I'd call it your pre-seed round is your most difficult. And in my how to make a standout pitch, I think I kind of dig into kind of what we're looking for. There's lots of little things I've picked up over the years. What I like to say is, you know, I'm looking for somebody that I see ringing the NASDAQ bell someday, right? They're just an amazing team. They have a history together. I'm definitely looking for two or three co-founders or more. A strong f a force that you sense, you know, a disturbance in the force, to use a Star Wars reference. You know, it's clear that this person's going to be successful, right? And maybe they're just so amazing. I'm questioning whether or not I should continue working in venture capital. Maybe I should go work for this person. That's the level. I'm just looking for people that impress me. And I've seen lots of impressive people working at Microsoft and Amazon and all the various startups. And I'm grateful to have such a great network of amazing folks. And so you're just kind of looking for amazing people. And you know, past it's funny, in typical investing, past performance is not indicative of future performance, but the inverse is kind of true in venture. It's kind of like past performance is predictive of future performance. And so you're looking for a history and string of past successes. Great founder market fit, a huge vision for what they want to accomplish, right? They're going to, you know, startups are the hardest thing you can possibly do professionally. It's literally, you're going to, and I've talked about this a lot on my podcast and with a lot of founders, and you're going to fail in some area of your life if you're going to do this startup. And I want to see somebody that's willing to make sacrifices and just knock down walls. Tenacity, vision, clarity of thought, people skills, passion, purpose, risk-taking, long-term thinking, customer focus, optimism, thinking based on fundamental or first principles, ability to coachable, ability to experiment and learn. And the list goes on. I have a long list of things I look for. And yeah.
Maybe we'll take another question from the crowd. Does a VC add value to the company other than financial? Do they help scale or acquire enterprise?
I love this. Network? I love this question. You know, because you can take both sides of it, right? You know, I took one side which says the best founders don't need my help, right? Which basically tells you like I'm not helpful at all. The other side of it is investors are enormously helpful, right? They can help you fundraise and fill your round. They can help guide you through the legal and financial complexities of scaling a startup. They can connect you to customers, to employees, to team members. There's so many ways that a VC can help. But so you got to find the right VC that can help you in the way that you need help.
Got it. Okay. Circling back, before we wrap up, I wanted to kind of go back on one thing. You mentioned you've worn every hat in a startup. How do you think that helps you be a better investor?
Yeah, I'm sort of unemployable, right? I've done a little bit of everything. It makes me a great investor and a really, really bad employee. You know, I've done sales, marketing, product, BD, biz ops. I've been an analyst. I've was even a recruiter. I've done finance and real estate. I've just done a lot of stuff. And so when it's a piece of HR software, I know how to evaluate that. If it's a fintech company, I know how to look at that. Oh, it's a sales tool, a martech tool, an ad tech tool. I've done all those things. I've both been the tool user and the tool builder. And so, yeah, it just makes you, I think, a great investor. It gives me a competitive edge on evaluating companies.
You know, I'm going to just inject my opinion on some of this. And from our conversation here, Brian, I will say this is that most investors are full of bluster. Look at me, I'm great. And a lot of investors have done some great things. In talking to you, Brian, I don't really get that in that the bluster, you're probably more self-effacing than you should be. You've probably done more than you are letting it be known here.
It's a big reason I didn't become a VC coming out of grad school. It's like I interacted with them. I was like, you guys are a bunch of blowhards. I don't want to be like you.
Right.
And a lot of VCs are. They think, you know, their shit doesn't stink and they're just the most amazing people. It's true. It's true. But I think you have to be down to earth and kind of humble and willing to like, I've made a lot of mistakes as an investor, as an employee, I built products that took dozens of people to build for many, many months that nobody used.
Right.
Waste of money, right? You know, I think you have to be, you know, honest with yourself and kind of know what your limitations are and be intellectually curious and honest.
Yeah, you know, in one of the startups I was at and sitting in the board meeting, there was one particular VC who I would describe as being the blowhard. He dominated the room. He, you know, every single question that came up, he insisted on having his opinion heard first, etc. And it was kind of difficult because that person was a ready, fire, aim type of person. And there was a guy kind of off.
I bet he takes board seats.
I'm sorry?
I bet he takes board seats.
Yeah. Yeah. But there was a guy who was off in the corner who was quiet, and that person listened to everything. And when we had this key decision on the table, trying to get some board feedback, that guy basically, when he spoke up, he asked a couple more questions to clarify and fill in some gaps in his knowledge. Then once those questions were answered, he gave a measured response. And I thought, that guy in the corner, he's not famous. You have a hard time. But the guy who was very vocal and very prominent, you can probably see that person just in TechCrunch. Okay, the guy's quoted in TechCrunch often. But I prefer talking to the guy who was the quiet guy because his feedback was better.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, just being willing to say that you failed. I mean, there is an old adage, success is a lousy teacher because you think you've arrived.
Right.
Right. but you learn more from your failures than your successes. I do appreciate just Brian, your willingness to just be humble and talk about that. I would encourage people that's part of the cultural fit that you want. If you get one of those blowhards on your board, yeah, maybe they can, get you some visibility that, yeah, we closed a deal from XYZ investor, okay? That guy invested in us, or that fund invested in us. You might have a really hard time managing that investor later down the road. Okay.
Yeah, you want to find people that most investments last longer than most marriages, right? So you want to find somebody you want to talk to for 10 or 15 years.
Yeah,
That's pretty important.
understand. We are past our time here and stuff. So thank you very much for sharing your feedback as we kind of wrap up here. Maybe I'll share a couple of things. Also, if you are interested, Fundable Startups, we do offer a good amount of help. We have self-paced training, a live training academy. We do coaching, and we help with fundraising and investor outreach. Okay. So if you are interested, just go ahead and take a look. You can scan the QR code there and book a free consultation with us. Okay. So Brian, thank you. This has been a very insightful conversation, especially since you do something that most investors don't, running the syndicate, and it helps give us some feedback. Any closing thought before we wrap up, Brian?
Don't give up. Figuring out what you want to create for the world and grind it out.
Absolutely. So thank you very much. I appreciate it. We will get the replay posted shortly. We're way behind on our posting schedule, so please be patient with us. Thank you very much. Thank you, Brian. Do take advantage of the open invitation to review Brian's investment profile and see if you might be a good fit for pitching Brian. Okay. Thanks, everybody.